And what's interesting is that although in the Bible story of Noah's Ark, you know, they talk about Noah taking on two each of the animals, you know, male and female, in a lot of the other legends, they don't talk about animals being taken on board. They talk about the seed of the animal or the essence of the animal being taken on board. And this actually gave rise to discussion in the Pentagon. Could it actually have been animal DNA they were taking on board? You know, the seed or the essence kind of doesn't sound like the complete animal. So the idea is, could it be that these vast arcs, these alien arcs, were like a huge databanks filled with animal DNA, you know, to reseed the planet if the floods were sort of really catastrophic. So again, I think the reason for the search for Noah's Ark was simply because they were looking to see if there was advanced technology involved that, again, could be utilized.
Yeah, you bring up that subject about maybe this was extraterrestrial in origin. Mm-hmm. And that brings me to the subject of ancient astronauts, and we were talking about religion here.
Yeah.
It seems to me that not only just the Christian religion, but quite a few religions have been a big roadblock to us accepting the idea that perhaps there's something to the ancient astronaut hypothesis. In other words, we were all starseeds.
Well, yeah, and I mean, this is, you know, I think this is one of the reasons why there's been so much secrecy around this, because, you know, religion is a very emotive topic, whichever side of the fence you're on. You know, if you're a believer, an agnostic or an atheist, it's still a big issue. You know, people debate it, and, you know, a lot of people don't want their belief systems questioned. And when you're talking not just thousands or even millions of people, but billions of people, you know, who believe in this religion or that religion, you know, to suggest that maybe some of these accounts of the gods coming down, you know, in flaming chariots were actually aliens coming down in UFOs, it would be very difficult, I think, for government agencies to go public and say that, you know, on the nightly news where the president stands up and says, you know, all these ancient beliefs you have, it's nonsense, you know, it's just that they're actually the equivalent of our NASA astronauts. You know, all hell would break loose. You know, they'd just be... chaos would just erupt everywhere.
Yeah, if a high government official like a president or somebody like that came out and said, yeah, we have proof of, you know, that there's alien intervention here, everybody would be up in arms. He'd be committing political suicide.
Well, that's one of the reasons I don't think the story is coming out is because the implications of what would happen afterwards, you know, not just as far as the public's concerned, but whichever party was in power, you know, the other one would have such a great tool. They could, you know, let's say the Democrats announced it. The Republicans would just say, you know, that this president's trying to destroy your God.
Atheistic liberals.
Yeah, exactly. And then if it was the other way around, you know, the other one would be doing it as well. And I think that's one of the reasons. Even if that story is true, you know, we don't know if it is true, but if the government suspects it is, I think part of the secrecy is purely and simply because nobody, even in government, knows how to tell the story without it creating just worldwide havoc, if you like.
You make of ancient astronauts. What kind of proof did you come across for the book?
Well, I mean, in fairness...
Or was it all supposition?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I point out in the book, that, you know, even though we're dealing with governments and secrecy, you know, at the end of the day, they're just like us. They're looking into a mystery and trying to solve it. And, you know, of course, if you're dealing with a UFO sighting from 24 hours ago, or even right now, you know, the military can scramble aircraft or check radar, etc. What they were doing with these ancient mysteries is very different because, you know, they were sort of looking into the mysteries of the past, things from thousands of years ago. Now, granted, you know, they had things like spy satellites and aircraft that could fly over Mount Ararat and photograph this so-called Ararat anomaly, you know, and they launched clandestine missions to, you know, investigate the pyramids and stuff like that. So they clearly had a bigger budget that allowed them to do things. But, you know, even when you're... with all that, if you're digging into a mystery that occurred 5,000 years ago, you know, you're going to be limited, I think, in what you can find, unless you actually stumble upon the thing. You know, it's like you could investigate the Ark of the Covenant, but you're only going to be able to take it so far unless you actually find the Ark of the Covenant. So I think that's why within government, you know, there were as many people who believed that what was found on Noah's, on Mount Ararat was Noah's Ark, as there were as many people who believed it was a UFO or something, some sort of advanced technology. So even in government, there was no real consensus because some people were driven by a religious belief and others were driven by like a UFO belief, kind of like us on the outside. You know, that's a big irony. They weren't thinking that different to those of us, you know, on the outside, you know. So.
Yeah. Another thing you wrote about in this book that always fascinates me is and just the term lost civilizations gets your mind spinning.
Yeah.
But I wonder why these civilizations became lost.
Well, you know, I mean, the one thing that all ancient religions and civilizations, you know, have in common when it comes to these stories about fantastic civilizations and beings, etc., is that they all seem to have come to a sudden end, you know, whether they blew themselves up, obliterated themselves, or wiped out by some plague, you know, or there was a planetary disaster, you know, like a meteorite hitting the planet or a flood, you know, that they all sort of, all these legends have one thing in common, and that's what it is. It's like these civilizations rose, they achieved fantastic things, and then they were gone. Now, one of the things I talk about in the book that relates to this issue of lost civilizations relates to none other than Dr. Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb. Oppenheimer, you know, he was, you know, without Oppenheimer, there wouldn't have been an atomic bomb, you know, and probably the Second World War wouldn't have ended as quickly as it did, you know, when the bombs were dropped on Japan. But Oppenheimer, as well as, you know, having a deep interest in atomic research, etc., and developing the bomb, he also had a more than an interest, but probably what you would call an obsession, with an ancient Indian text, the Mahabharata, which basically, I mean, how old this is, nobody really knows. You know, some estimates suggest 8,000 years old. Other people have suggested that it's actually based on an even older document, possibly, you know, going back tens and tens and tens of thousands of years. And it basically tells of like a localized war in India between two rival factions. But, you know, you'd imagine that for that sort of era, it would be talking about, you know, fighting with chariots and bows and arrows and spears and shields and that sort of thing. But it actually doesn't. It talks about the battle being fought with these flying vehicles known as Vimanas, which, when you read the description of them, they sound like some sort of, you know, jet-powered fighter plane or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they fired, reportedly, these, you know, sort of these powerful iron rods that at the, you know, the opposing cities. And when they did that, you know, it would result in this huge pillar of flame and smoke go up into the sky, which would hang there for days. You know, it sounds like an atomic mushroom cloud. And more intriguing, the soldiers would start to fall sick and die in the days afterwards, not, you know, immediately from the blast. And this kind of sounds like radiation poisoning. It even talks about, you know, the soldiers, the nails falling out and things like that, and jumping into rivers to try and wash themselves, which sounds like a, you know, an emergency attempt to decontaminate yourself against, you know, radiation poisoning. And when you put all these different pieces together, you know, these iron rods, you know, firing these brilliant explosions and blowing up cities and this huge plume of smoke hanging in the air ominously for days and soldiers getting sick. When you put all that together, it sounds like an ancient nuclear war. And the fact that none other than the father of the atomic bomb, Robert Oppenheimer, was obsessed by it, you know, makes you wonder if he knew some parts of government secrets, you know, about, hey, you know, we found that we weren't the first ones to develop atomic energy. And more intriguingly, in 1952, at a conference in D.C., Oppenheimer was asked, you know, were the atomic bombs that, you know, we detonated, the first test one in New Mexico in 45, and then the two dropped on Japan. He was asked, you know, were they the first atomic examples of atomic bombs having been developed? And Oppenheimer said, yes, and then he paused for a second, and he added, in the modern era, you know, as if to say, well, yeah, we were the first ones to develop them in the modern era, but not in the ancient era, you know. So it's almost as if he was giving a few little hints and secrets that he knew we weren't the first, you know, that maybe somebody came before us and had obliterated themselves. But the Mahabharata doesn't talk about like a worldwide war, it's like a localized one. And I think that makes more sense, you know, that there could have been highly advanced localized civilizations like this one, like the Atlanteans, etc., who vanished completely because it wasn't like a worldwide thing like our civilization today. It was sort of localized in different areas.
Well, we talk about lost civilizations, everyone thinks of Atlantis, or at least most people.
Yeah.
But evidently there's been quite a few lost civilizations.
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, if we look at our world today, you know, we've basically got a worldwide civilization. And although, you know, some countries are highly advanced and others are still living in, you know, sort of jungle huts or whatever. But for the most part, it's like a network of a one civilization, you know, whether it's North America, South America, Europe, Russia, China, the Far East, Middle East, you know, it's a civilization. But what I kind of get from looking at these ancient stories is that there wasn't this huge worldwide civilization that flourished and destroyed itself, but it seems certain parts of the world, you know, the people advanced very quickly or were helped, you know, you could argue by extraterrestrials, like Egypt, you know, the pyramids were being built, there are other parts of the world where people really were, you know, still in caves or whatever. So I think that might explain why some of these civilizations, there's no trace of them. Because if it was a worldwide thing, we'd find far more evidence. But if it was like a localized small country that got obliterated, you know, that would
I guess when we talk about lost civilizations, sometimes there's markers or historical monuments and things that really kind of point to what you're saying.
That's kind of present day evidence. Yeah, and I think the other thing to remember as well, you know, with all these ancient floods stories, then, you know, there's a lot of stories about, you know, possibly some of these ancient civilizations may have actually, what would have been land in their period, you know, is not now the bottom of the Pacific or whatever, you know, and some of these deeper levels in the ocean, we're just, even today, not able to get to. So, you know, who knows if there are ancient structures down there that, you know, when the earth was in turmoil and, you know, there were earthquakes and tidal waves and floods, etc., maybe a lot of this land still exists, but, you know, it's now at the bottom of the ocean, you know, where the land once was or whatever. So.
You know, this is a UFO show, so I got to bring that up for a little bit here. And in your book, you seem to hint that you feel that maybe it's a little more than a hint that UFO evidence has been hinting over the years.
Oh, well, yeah, there's no doubt about
that. And it's pretty obvious as we do UFO shows. Obviously, that's true about present day, but...
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, one of the interesting angles or stories I relate in the book actually relates to the Dead Sea Scrolls, which in a weird way actually has an ancient UFO link to it. We know now, thanks to a man named Miles Copeland, who was a senior CIA operative in the CIA, he, in 1947, was working out of the CIA's office in Damascus, and he's gone on record, or went on record, I should say, he's dead now, but he went on record as stating that on one day in 1947, the year in which the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, that a guy, like a mysterious Bedouin-type character, came into the embassy, the American embassy where his office was based, and said he had something important he wanted to show to somebody in a position of authority. And it was basically like an ancient scroll, like a Dead Sea Scroll, written in some very ancient and archaic language, which Copeland obviously didn't understand. And it was sent to the CIA for it to be deciphered, you know, by code breakers, etc. And supposedly it related to the Book of Daniel, which talks all about weird prophecies and dreams and things like that. And what's interesting is, you know, again, like with Noah's Ark, why would the CIA be interested in analyzing the Dead Sea Scrolls? You know, that would be more of the work of historians or archaeologists. But there's another strand to the story, and it relates not to just UFOs, but crashed UFOs. In the 80s and 90s, a number of UFO researchers, including Bill Steinman and Tim Cooper, were both given stories by sort of whistleblower types, if you like, who told them that in a number of UFO crashes in New Mexico in 1947-48, that when the military got there and got inside these craft, they found these weird parchments that look retrospectively now like the Dead Sea Scrolls. You know, so the idea of finding a crashed UFO is, you know, sort of sensational enough. Finding ancient parchments inside them, you know, takes it to a whole nother level. Now, that in itself is a controversial story, which I admit in the book we're not able to verify. But we can verify the Miles Copeland story that the CIA, in 47 of all years, was researching the Dead Sea Scrolls. So, you know, this sort of opens up another can of worms that links ancient artifacts, relics, etc., with crashed UFOs and alien technology.
Yeah, you know, you're connecting some dots there, and maybe some people says it's a stretch, but other people, including myself, thinks you may be onto something.
Well, you know, I mean, the interesting thing is that regardless of whatever the truth is behind these crashed UFO and, you know, scroll stories, etc., for some reason in the 80s and 90s, somebody in government wanted to promote the idea that Dead Sea Scroll type artifacts had been found in crashed saucers in New Mexico in 47. You know, the stories that were leaked out spanned, you know, more than 10 years, and from Bill Steinman in the mid-80s through Tim Cooper in the late 90s. And, you know, so somebody clearly wanted to get this story out. And as I said, you know, people can sort of roll their eyes and say there's nothing to it, except for one intrigue. In fact, that in 47, you know, Roswell thought was 47, Kenneth Arnold was 47. And the one thing we know for sure, thanks to Miles Copeland and various other people who come forward, is that in that very year, the CIA was researching the Dead Sea Scrolls out of the Middle East. So, you know, that then doesn't make the other aspect of the story too unbelievable, if you like. So.
Yeah. We're talking with Nick Redfern, and you'll be at the Wake Up Now conference in Albuquerque coming up in August.
Yep.
10 through 12. What are you going to speak about there?
I'll probably speak about this, actually, Jerry, you know, sort of the breaking stories about these ancient artifacts and, you know, what the government knows. Because, you know, it's one of these areas where everybody, I think, knows the general stuff, like Eric von Daniken and Zechariah Sitchin. Not many people are aware of the government's involvement in it. So, you know, I think I'll probably talk about that because it'll, you know, be sort of new and fresh for people.
Over your years of research, you've dug into some pretty interesting stories. What has surprised you most? To me, it seems like it would probably be like what we've been talking about here. The government's interested in all kinds of things
would be. No, I mean, I actually would agree with you on that, Jerry. I mean, everybody knows, you know, regardless of what people think UFOs are, everybody knows the government's investigated them, you know, but this actually surprised me was doing the research, was the sheer extent to which governments had investigated ancient artifacts, etc. You know, everything from Dead Sea Scrolls, pyramids, Ark of the Covenant, you know, Atlantis, pyramids and levitation, the Mayan prophecies, Stonehenge. You know, they were literally running around like government equivalents of Indiana Jones, you know, and just trying to find all this stuff.
And you mentioned Mayan prophecies, and we're talking about lost civilizations. It's not lost on me that we're talking about 2012 and all of those rumors. I don't know if civilizations would disappear just like that. Any evidence of how that happens?
Well, not really. I mean, the best we can say about those in the past is that, you know, a lot of them are connected with vast worldwide disasters like floods. You know, I mean, a massive worldwide flood caused by something like a polar tilt, you know, would wipe out entire cultures. There's no doubt about that. You know, even like a 5-foot raise in the water levels would just be disastrous, you know, for whole nations. So, you know, if there's something really cataclysmic occurred across the world, then, you know, that would explain, I think, why a lot of these civilizations would be wiped out. But, I mean, in terms of the 2012 thing, I mean, you know, whatever's going to happen, if anything's going to happen, we haven't got long to wait to find out. But one of the things I would say, you know, a lot of people get really sort of worried about this, but if you look at the original Mayan prophecies, what they said was that December 21st, 2012, basically is the end of a cycle. The Mayas believe that the Earth or civilization developed in cycles. And it's that word cycle that's got people puzzled. Does it mean the end of the world or the end of civilization where we have to start over? Or does it just mean like a cultural shift or a mind shift or a spiritual shift? You know, like a beginning of a new era of, you know, how we appreciate things or whatever. You know, the Maya prophecies actually don't say anything about the world ending or, you know, tsunamis or comets hitting the world. They just say it'll be the end of the current era. But that doesn't necessarily mean disaster. It could just mean a new appreciation of the planet or something, you know.
Okay, tell the name of the book again for people.
All right, so the Pyramids and the Pentagon, and it's available from all good outlets, whether online, you know, or bookstores as well. So.
And I know of two or three books you've written this year. You must write an average of four or five a year.
I do about two a year. But what sometimes happens is that because I'm with several publishers, what occasionally happens is that, you know, I'll write one and they'll hold on to it for a year or 6 months, and then coincidentally it'll come out at the same time or a couple of months after one of the other publishers. So it looks like I've cranked out three or four in 1 year, when one might have just been sitting in the office, you know, for 12 months, and then they all put them out together, you know. So I probably do about two a year. So.
Yeah. Now, the Wake Up Now conference coming up August 10th through 12th, you'll be there.
That's correct.
You go other places too. I've seen you all around. So
yeah, I do a lot of lectures. Actually, I was down talking about this book actually in Houston on Sunday yesterday. I just drove back home today, and I'll be in Minneapolis in October, a conference there. So you know, I like to travel around and get the word out, and you know, sort of hang out with people and have a good time.
Yeah, that conference up in Minneapolis, I believe Von Doniken's going to be there.
That's correct, yeah. So I'm going to be talking about this book there as well, and, you know, it should be a good conference.
Yeah, that'd be very interesting. Nick, you got any closing thoughts? We're almost out of time.
Well, you know, I always say to people, you know, if you're interested in all this stuff, get researching, because you could be the one person who sort of really, you know, blows the lid on all this. A lot of people have been looking into this, you know, for decades and decades. And, you know, when you go looking, you know, as I demonstrated with this book, you can find some weird stuff. And, you know, if you're interested and you want to find the answers, then, you know, you might be the one who finds the real answers or the full answers, you know.
Okay, thanks very much, Nick Redfern. We'll be talking soon.
Thanks, Jerry.
The Wake Up Now conference in Albuquerque in August.
All right, cool.
Hi, this is Jerry Pippin inviting you to join me and Nancy Wallace in Albuquerque, New Mexico on Friday, August 10th at the Albuquerque Marriott for the opening of the second annual Wake Up Now conference. From the 10-minute opening guided meditation to the closing event on Sunday, you will be treated to a journey into awareness that you will treasure for the rest of your life. 60 vendor spaces, 12 major speakers, including Bill Murphy, Brooks Agnew, David Weatherly, Lynn Buchanan, Nick Redfern, and Patty Greer in person, plus a screening of her latest film. Check out all the information by entering Wake Up Now Conference in your search engine, or go to the banners on our website at jerrypippin.com. This is a benefit for the Pace Setting School of Now. We'll see you in Albuquerque.